Welcome back to Shake Up Your Workup, your go-to veterinary podcast for daily diagnostics. Each episode, we dive into innovative diagnostics and real-world clinical practice to help practitioners navigate both typical and not-so-typical workups. In this episode of Shake Up Your Workup, Dr. Sylvia Conway chats with Dr. Nancy Sanders to walk through a clear, stepwise approach to the PU-PD patient, from confirming it's real to choosing the smartest next diagnostic steps. Let's get started. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Shake Up Your Workup. I'm your host, Dr. Sylvia Conway, and today's episode is Thirsty Workups, Simplifying Your Approach to the PU-PD Patient. Our guest today is Dr. Nancy Sanders, and Nancy is an IDEXX Medical Education Specialist. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you for welcoming. How are you today?
I'm great, thank you. And it's not your first time with us, is it, Nancy?
Welcome back.
So thank pleased you. To have you back. The downside for you of being back is we can't ask you the same intro question that we asked you last time. So I'm going to ask you a new one just to get a feel for who you are, Nancy, before we delve into the clinical side of things. So if you could pick a dog breed that best describes or best represents your energy, which dog breed would you choose and why?
That's a tough question, Sylvia. Always start with those in the beginning. I would say we probably get the breeds that most represent us, right? So I've always had Jack Russells, and I do feel like that fits me best, but I might be a little bit of a mixed breed. So you might need a genetic test. I think I'd be 75% Jack Russell running around like a crazy person, but the good Jack Russell that chases things but doesn't kill things, right? And then the and then probably a couch potato dog, maybe like a beagle, an older beagle that likes to very loyal, sits with owner and watches TV. So yeah, I think I'm a combination of those two.
Best of both worlds. Awesome. So today's topic, PU-PD, it's quite a large topic. We're being ambitious today, trying to cover such a large topic. So we'll start at the very beginning. It's a very common presentation that we see in GP, first opinion practice. What would be the questions that you would always ask a pet parent when they bring in their pet presenting with PU-PD?
So there's a couple that I think we sometimes miss and really need to focus on. First of all, a good history, particularly a diet history. You'd be surprised at how much diet can affect how much a patient or a pet drinks. So particularly if there's been any changes in diet since the PU-PD began, did we change from a wet food to a dry food? Treats, we've seen these dogs that get the jerky freeze-dried treats that then get the Fanconi-like syndrome, and that's a huge thing. So asking that question specifically, if there's any changes in treats, are they adding salt to the diet? Are they cooking for the pet? So those types of things. Certainly, I want to know exactly when the client thought the PU-PD began, and was it like a gradual onset or a really acute onset? And again, kind of tie that in with any changes in husbandry. Are there any changes in attitude or activity, things like that, along with the PU-PD? So is the dog acting or the cat acting totally fine in PU-PD, or is it now slowing down, feeling ill, doing other things? Certainly things like changes in weight can be clues too. So I ask if the pet has lost or gained weight, because that might lead me in one direction or another, right? A patient that's gaining weight in PU-PD might think about Cushing's versus a patient that is losing weight. I might think about some other things like diabetes or other illnesses.
I think the diet's a really good one because that's something that I think we always want to jump to the really cool stuff and like, oh, this could be this disease, it could be that disease. And diet is just something that it could just be,
absolutely,
as you said, a change in the diet.
I've had cases referred to me after a pretty big expensive workup, and then I got hold of them and asked about the diet, and the diet was changed. You know, still don't know that that's the cause, but changed the diet back and pet was better, and that, you know, didn't bode well for how the owner felt about their primary pet after that, right?
Yeah, the kid secretly feeding chips under the table and you wonder why the dog suddenly drinking so much. Excellent advice there. So that's kind of from the history perspective. In terms of the signalment perspective, are there certain times or certain signalments that make you think,
you know, I know we shouldn't pattern spot. It's not advisable to pattern spot. We were always taught that. But are there certain sort of signalments where you jump to, okay, I need to test this?
Yeah, certainly the very old, gruff-looking kitty, I'll think about things like hyperthyroidism and kidney disease versus the obese cat, I'm thinking diabetes, or I should say overconditioned these days, right? Diabetes, the dog that looks Cushingoid, you know, so there are certain breeds that I think about with Cushing's as well. So some of our little breed dogs like the poodles, and schnauzers versus, I also think about diabetes with schnauzers, but yeah, definitely breed and age may change what I'm thinking. There's certain breeds I think about cancer, unfortunately. So the boxer and the golden retriever that comes in, I'm always going to be worried about, do they have cancer and hypercalcemia? Yeah.
How do you ensure that the pet genuinely is PUPD and it's not just the owner is home more and seeing them drink more and wee more, or like how do you confirm that this is a genuine case of PUPD, or do you not, you just take the owner's word for it?
Absolutely have to confirm it, and so the first most important thing is probably the urine specific gravity. Now, there are cases where the urine specific gravity is very concentrated, but the owner is still absolutely certain that their pet is PUPD. And it's possible that they have a pet that used to be, you know, a camel and barely drink at all and have really concentrated urine. And now it's drinking more than it used to. And the urine is a little bit more dilute than it used to be, but still quite concentrated. So, you have to do a combination of the two for sure. And then certainly blood work, but I might get as far as having to have the owner measure water intake and get a couple of urine samples first thing in the morning, but that may not reflect what happens during the day. So sometimes I'll have them get different urine samples throughout the day as well.
And is it possible to be PUPD but have a normal urine concentration?
So that is a really tough question and not easy to answer, because you first have to answer the question of what is normal urine specific gravity, right? And I don't like to think of urine in that way. I like to think of it as, is urine specific gravity appropriate for the situation or inappropriate, right? Because we could have dilute urine in a patient that's very well hydrated, and that could be totally appropriate and therefore not help me with the question of PUPD. One, again, we have to look at the what is normal. But if the, let's say the urine is well concentrated and the person thinks their pet is PUPD, technically, it is probably not, so that, because there are some very specific guidelines that we have to go through in terms of how much water they're drinking and how much urine, but the pet could still be relatively PUPD to what it used to be. So it's possible. It's a very gray zone in there. Yeah.
Okay. Can you be polydipsic without being polyuric, or do they always happen together?
Right. That's a perfect, and that's a really good question. So in most, probably 98% of our cases, I'm guessing, this isn't by literature by any means, polyuria drives polydipsia, right? Something causes the urine to be dilute first, and then the animals have to drink more to keep up with that. But you will have occasions where a pet is losing fluid for some other reason, having a lot of diarrhea, panting a lot all the time, some other effusion somewhere, in which case, yes, they could be polydipsic to keep up with that fluid loss, but not be polyuric because there's nothing wrong with their kidneys. They're getting dehydrated and their kidneys are still concentrating urine. So you could be polydipsic without being polyuric.
So are there any cases where you would kind of jump to additional testing or secondary testing, even at that point where you're taking your minimum database? So you're looking at the patient and you're thinking, I am sure that this is a blah, 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 or I really think I should test this additional parameter in this dog based on its history or its presentation.
Yeah, there might be a few cases. It's pretty rare because I generally want to see the general just CBC chemistry urine analysis first. But if I've done that in-house, there may be some changes that make me do something else. And there are a few histories. So for example, the dog that has a chronic history of subtle symptoms, like doesn't deal well with stress, it's got GI signs over and other things haven't come out, I probably would add on a cortisol and ideally an in-house cortisol so I can find out right away if a dog might have Addison's or atypical Addison's disease. If I have a dog that has, let's say we did the urine analysis in-house and I see a lot of protein in the urine, I might do a 4DX to rule out vector-borne diseases. Cystatin B, if there's any question that a patient has had some sort of acute kidney injury, so it's gotten into like non-steroidals, or maybe it's just older and it has some history of potential renal issues, I might do a cystatin B to see if there's any acute kidney injury. If there's azotemia, and again, it's very acute, and maybe the dog is an indoor-outdoor dog or goes swimming, I definitely want to test for lepto. So I might even do like a lepto snap in-house or send out some lepto testing, either PCR or ELISA or both, depending on the situation. If I see physical exam changes, particularly in a cat, but maybe in a dog, like retinal changes or that cat that comes in with the blown retinas, I'm going to get a blood pressure right away. Those are the things that I can think of. If there's protein in the urine, maybe urine protein creatinine ratio also right away. So those are some of the things that I could think of I might be doing right away. If I feel masses, big lymph nodes, maybe aspirates, maybe a cancer 4DX, maybe some imaging.
Again, I think it just really highlights that you need to get your good history and your really thorough physical exam to make sure you're not missing anything so that you can take the next steps confidently saying, I felt this, or, you know, the history is this, which is why I think we need to go down this route rather than this route, because it is, unfortunately, such a non-specific symptom that there are many, many directions we could go in. So I think it's a case of going back and keep looking at that history and seeing what you might have missed to try and point you in the correct direction for these cases.
I agree. And also those ones that are acutely PPD, like those are the ones I'm worried about, may have something that's going to be rapidly progressive and I need answers more quickly than that patient that comes in that's been PPD for weeks or months.
Okay. So we've got a patient, they've presented with PPD. We have confirmed via a urine sample that it genuinely is PPD that the owner is observing. What's our next steps? So in terms of diagnostics, what do we do now?
So not to assume this, but absolutely a really thorough physical exam, right? We want to particularly feel things like lymph nodes and for masses and the rectal and a retinal exam for numerous reasons. So really thorough physical exam, but my baseline lab results are going to be a full CBC, a chemistry, including the electrolytes and an SDMA and a urinalysis. And that's all three parts of the urine with the urine specific gravity, the sediment and the biochemical part.
And this is really because it is quite an unspecific sign generally, isn't it? PUPD.
Correct.
So we do have to kind of throw out the wide net to make sure that we're not going to miss anything.
Correct.
Are there cases though, where you do get a little bit more kind of focused and you think based on this, I am actually going to, you know, I'm going to do my MDB, but I'm also going to add in this from the get-go, or I'm going to do some imaging for the get-go. Are there kind of signs or things that would make you jump to the next step, sort of secondary testing before you've got your MDB results?
There are probably a few things, like the older cat. I'm absolutely going to have a T4 in any cat over 6 years old. But even if it's a little bit younger, I might add in a T4 for a kitty. If I had a dog that looks Cushingoid, I certainly might consider. Well, it's not a good screening test for Cushing's, but let me go the opposite way. If I have a dog that has had a lot of GI signs chronically and other issues and is thin and is PUPD, I might add in a resting cortisol to help rule out Addison's. You know, maybe a urine cortisol creatinine ratio as a screen for Cushing's, maybe, depending on the owners, you know, where they want to go with that. Potentially, it's certainly imaging if I feel a mass or hear something weird in the chest or have a cat with a non-compressible chest and I'm worried about some sort of mediastinal mass or something in the chest. So there's times that I might add in some other death diagnostics.
So you did touch on kind of masses, making feeling around and making sure you don't have masses and whatnot. So I'm kind of taking that as a segue into hypercalcemia. So when I have detected there's a hypercalcemia, When do I need an ionized calcium? When do I not need an ionized calcium?
All right. That's also a great question, Dr. Sylvia. So I would say certainly if a patient has an elevated total calcium, always I will do an ionized calcium. Always. Because there are some things that might make that calcium a little bit high that might be spurious or normal for that pet versus, and in which case the ionized calcium will be normal. So we always, you know, if the ionized calcium is normal, I'm not as worried about an elevated total calcium. So I always want that ionized calcium with an elevated total calcium. There are some times that I have a patient that has a normal total calcium, but it's either been trending upwards over time. We have some older labs or lab results, or potentially a patient that has PUPD and I can find nothing else, like all the general lab work is within the reference range, then in those cases, I might do an ionized calcium as well, particularly if I'm feeling like big lymph nodes or masses or something to that effect.
And in terms of kind of cancers, would this be, when would you, I know IDEX has a new cancer markers, the IDEX Cancer DX, would that be useful in these cases? When would you reach to kind of use that test to rule out that there's an underlying cancer?
Yeah, that's, I think it's a great time to use particularly IDEX's Cancer DX test, which is looking for a lymphoma, at least in dogs. So yeah, if I've got big lymph nodes and PUPD or hypercalcemia, lymphoma cancer is certainly of the top 10 differentials for causing hypercalcemia, and lymphoma is the top cancer that will do that. So absolutely the Cancer DX or maybe some of the other novel biomarkers, it's a great time to use that.
Let's delve a little bit into kind of more difficult or complex cases. So I think psychogenic PUPD is one of the ones that is always a bit of a struggle for us. Can you, have you made that diagnosis? How have you made that diagnosis? Is it common? Because I think it's something that's always in the back of our minds, but we never really know whether to cross that bridge and actually make that diagnosis. Is it something that you've seen, Nancy?
So I have seen it maybe in two or three cases over, 22 years of practice and 35 years of being a veterinarian. I think I've maybe seen two or three cases. It's super rare. It does exist. We do have to sometimes look for it, but it is super, super rare. And we have to keep that in mind. I feel like a lot of people do jump to testing for particularly diabetes insipidus and psychogenic water drinking at those two are kind of the last thing you look for, but a lot of people jump to that first, and we really have to do that last.
And how do you test for this? Is there a way you can test for psychogenic?
Yeah, essentially you're doing a modified water deprivation test. And if they fail it, they've got diabetes insipidus, assuming you've ruled out all other causes of nephrogenic, basically causes of decreased urine or decreased urine specific gravity. And if they pass the test, then they have psychogenic.
It always feels so cruel, these water deprivation tests. It always makes you feel like it's like an awful thing to do.
It is, and it can be, life-threatening if they truly can't concentrate their urine, which is why another reason why we want to do this last.
Mm-hmm. Talking of kind of complicated cases, so let's move a little bit onto cats, because let's face it, cats are really good at hiding everything from us. They have their own lives. They go and do their own thing. And I think PUPD is something that we're probably not detecting in our cats as easily as we're detecting in our dogs. Certainly mine have one of these fancy litter boxes that cleans. And, I could go in and look at how many times they're going a day just to and notice that there's been an increase. But for people that just have the standard litter box, a standard water bowl, the cat's doing its own thing inside, outside, whatever. Are we missing a lot of these cases? And what would be your tips for cat owners so that they kind of stay on top of this and know if their cat's becoming PUPD?
Right. I think that the cat question goes either way. Like either it's really obvious to some people because they have an old fashioned litter box and now suddenly they've got huge clumps of litter. As long as they're indoor cats, actually, I think it's a lot easier to pick it up. The other thing cats will do is start drinking out of weird places that they didn't used to do, like out of the sink and out of the toilet, and want to be in the tub with you or, near the tub or shower when you're taking a shower. Like, so I think in general, strictly indoor cats, it's actually pretty easy to pick up if you're an observant person. For the ones that are going indoor, outdoor, or like you said, like these new fancy litter boxes may make it harder to notice. I don't have an easy answer for that other than just being observant of your cat. I think the biggest thing will be noticing where they're drinking, if they're drinking other than their water bowl. Yeah, the water fountains also make it tough because they're constantly running. But if you notice your cat kind of hanging around water places more, I think that can be a good hint.
So if we have a PUPD patient and we've done our due diligence, we've done a minimum database and including a full urinalysis, and the results are all within normal limits, can we at that point say, okay, there's, I don't know what else to do. This is psychogenic. Let's test for psychogenic. Let's test for those final things. Can we rule out medical disorders at that point, or is there more things that we need to do?
Yeah, so we cannot rule out medical disorders. I think that's something that is rare when we do like CBC chemistry urinalysis, and other than the urine specific gravity, everything is normal, well within the normal limits, not trending in weird directions for the patient, right? I think that's something that I see commonly because those are the cases that get referred to me, but that people don't, I think in general, it's not a very common issue. So luckily, most of the time, thank goodness, our PUPD patients are kind of obvious what's wrong with them as soon as you do that, or where you're going with the initial database. But when you get those patients where all that stuff is normal or within reference range, that's when I say we start going looking for zebras. And you still have to do the workup of all the things that can cause PUPD, with the exception maybe of diabetes. You still have to go looking for all those things, even though the tests are normal. So that's when I call liver disease, kidney disease, things like that. Zebras, lepto, like they're all rare to have normal lab works, but lab results, but it does happen. So I would say you have to do things like a bile acids test. Blood pressure is another big one. Hypertension can cause PPD and you may not see any changes on your lab work. Going back to re-getting that history, make sure the client is not like putting anything with cortisone on the patient's skin or in the ears, or, you know, doing something that you're not aware of, pulling out those drugs that they saved from 5 years ago, the prednisone, and start giving it because their pet's itching. So going back to the big history and really asking specific questions, going back to your physical and really looking at that, making sure you've done a retinal exam, see if there's any potential symptoms of hypertension. So blood pressure, I will test patients for leptospirosis. Believe it or not, I've seen more patients with leptospirosis and normal labs other than a low specific gravity than I have certainly psychogenic polydipsia or diabetes insipidus. That really happens. I might do something like a cystatin B to see if there's any acute renal issue, especially if they've got an acute history and all the lab work's normal. Doing a cystatin B could be helpful. You might have to start trending renal biomarkers and calcium and blood pressure if everything's coming up normal. But there's a lot to do still before you get to that water deprivation test.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like, I mean, that's an awful lot of different options that you could go to. So I guess it's Go back to the owner, look through it again, have a deeper conversation and see what you might have missed to try and help you to point you in which direction you should go.
Exactly. And then kind of prioritizing what is a more out of the uncommon things that happen with normal lab work, still what's the more common issues. And then also potentially prioritizing what's non-invasive before you get into invasive and more expensive diagnostics. So again,
and depriving them. Try not to deprive them of water till the very last minute.
Exactly. Some cats, I might do like a free T4. The T4 is normal, but I, you know, I might do a free T4 or even, you know, rarely do we do the T3 suppression test anymore. And usually we can get our answers from total T4 and free T4. But yeah, you just have to start poking around and or repeating labs.
You mentioned the zebras, and I know that you have probably seen a lot of zebras in your time. Can you just tell us about some of those weird and wonderful cases? Just a really quick overview of some of the really weird ones that you still remember. Like this one was PUPD and I tested this and this and this and this and it ended up being this. You know, like, do you have any spring to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few. They don't really feel totally like zebras to me, other than I had to go through a whole lot of hoops to find the diagnosis. So certainly, I've had my share of golden retrievers that were PUPD and blood work's all normal, and I don't feel any big lymph nodes, but I can't find the answers. I've gone to as far as an ionized calcium, and maybe it's slightly elevated or normal, and I've had to go as far as get to a bone marrow to prove that a patient had, you know, could find cancer nowhere else. Now, this is before Cancer DX was out. Mm-hmm. I wish we'd had that back then, and maybe it would have given me some answers. Certainly, I had the pets with the diet changes that clients didn't think of asking, or my, you know, the referring vets didn't ask, and certainly the clients didn't think about that. Oh, I did have one pet that had liver disease, and again, blood work all normal. I think the bile acids were, we went as far as bile acids. I think even that was normal. But one of the drivers of PUPD in dogs with liver disease can be something psychogenic, or it can also be, there's a lot of different thoughts of why dogs with liver disease have PUPD, but another thought is that it's some form of hepatoencephalopathy. So just putting the dog on a lower protein diet seemed to help, even though its bile acids were normal. So I've seen some weird things.
So much like your mixed breed dog, Nancy, there's no real kind of black and white straight answers for these PUPD patients. But if you had to summarize it, what would be your top three tips for working up the PUPD patient?
So top three tips, I would say be very specific about and thorough about your history and physical exam. And don't forget things like rectal and retinal exams. Start with the basics. Always start with the basics. So CBC chemistry, urinalysis. Don't do things like jumping to testing for Cushing's without having done the basics first. I've seen that patient that got tested for Cushing's. The test came up positive, started treating the dog for Cushing's. And then we get follow-up blood work to see if they're having problems with the medication and they're azotemic or they're diabetic or, you know, something else. And, you know, probably the Cushing's test was false positive because the pet was ill. So don't skip the basics. Go through systematically what results you have now to help guide if and where you go next.
Perfect. Thanks so much for coming on the show today, Nancy.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a wonderful time. Dr. Conway is always with you.
Thanks for tuning in. This episode was hosted by Dr. Sylvia Conway and produced by me, Isolde Schroeder, with consulting producers Hannah Fries and Kate Benjamin. Shake Up Your Workup aims to share helpful information and guidance. However, listeners are cautioned that diagnostic recommendations or discussions shared during this episode may not be applicable to every situation, and regulations regarding diagnostics and treatment may vary by region. Listeners should always consult with their own veterinarian or qualified animal health professional before making any decisions regarding any diagnostics, treatments, or patient care. To learn more about the topics discussed today, check out the episode description for links to resources and free online courses on the IDEXX Learning Center. Follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts so you never miss an episode of Shake Up Your Workup. We'd also love to hear from you. Please share your comments, feedback, or any questions by emailing us at shakeupyourworkup@idexx.com. And as always, thanks for listening, and we'll be here next month when we shake up our workup with tapeworms. And should we be worried?